Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its author's intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special two-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.
Welcome to Slate's I Have to Ask. I'm Isaac Chotiner. My guest today is Lydia Polgreen, the editor-in-chief of HuffPost. Polgreen spent nearly 15 years at the New York Times, where she was a bureau chief in West Africa, and she also reported from India before becoming the editorial director of New York Times Global. Several months ago, she took over Arianna Huffington's old job at the Huffington Post, renamed it HuffPost, and has announced plans to expand the website's presence in the age of Trump. Polgreen joins me from HuffPost's New York City offices. Lydia, thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate having you on.
You're welcome. Thanks for your interest.
I wanted to start by asking you why it is you decided to leave the Times to come to HuffPost.
You know, I had worked at the New York Times for almost 15 years, and I'd had a very really wonderful career there. I'd had what had always been my dream job, which is to be a foreign correspondent in Africa. I worked in West Africa, in South Asia, and in South Africa. And I, you know, came back. I was deputy international editor, was sort of climbing the management ladder. And really, it had never really crossed my mind to leave the Times because, you know, it's this great temple of journalism. And, you know, they'd always treated me really, really well. But, you know, after the election, it just became clear to me that there was an enormous white space in the media landscape that needed to be filled by someone. You know, you have these news organizations like the New York Times, like the Washington Post, the FT, Economist, who are doing really, really great journalism and, you know, are speaking really directly to the same group of people. There is a kind of elite audience that's extremely well served by elite media. And I had really started to think in the aftermath of the 2016 election, what would it mean to have a news organization that didn't see itself as necessarily writing about people who feel left out of the political and economic power equations, but really for them, and what that might look like?
Just to talk about how we got to that divide that you're talking about, do you think that the fact that a lot of people don't trust the media is a result of the fact that the media is not writing for them, or do you think that there are other societal things at work?
I think we're living through a time in which all institutions are suffering from major loss of trust, right? I mean, there's a crisis of trust across the board. People don't have trust or faith in government. They don't have trust or faith in big business. Faith in even religious institutions. Across the board, we're seeing this loss of trust and loss of faith. And I think that the media is very naturally kind of caught up in that. If you look at the data from the 2016 Pew survey, about 18% of Americans said they had a high level of trust in the national media, which is a really, really small number. And you know, I sort of correlate that with, you know, the fact that since 1990, about 250,000 journalism jobs have vanished, the vast majority of them being in local journalism. And I think there's a really, this loss of trust in some ways feels to me related to deepening inequality. And deepening inequality is very much tied to centralization of power, you know, whether it's economic power, political power, social power. And so as a result of that, I think you're seeing that you have fewer and fewer people who feel like they're bought into the institutions of power, but instead feel like they're acted upon by those institutions.
You wrote in your editor's letter, you said, and yet in the aftermath of the sort of introductory letter you sent to readers when you took over the job, you said, and yet in the aftermath of the 2016 presidential election, a lot of journalists are asking ourselves whether our audience should trust us. How were we so wrong? Do you think the main error from journalism in the 2016 election was that Trump's chances were understated? I guess I'm wondering, what is it that you think journalists did wrong in the last election, and what can we do better?
I think it's a couple of things. You know, the fact is that there was an incredibly strong reliance on reporting around data. You know, we certainly saw that at the New York Times on election night. There was that infamous ticker that, you know, showed that there was a, you know, at points 80%+ chance of Hillary winning. And this feeling of inevitability around a Hillary win based on polling data. Now, of course, it turned out that the polling data, in many cases was actually not that far off. You know, this was a very close election, and, you know, just a, you know, fewer than 100,000 votes, going another way in a couple of select states. And, you know, we'd be telling a very different story. But I think we all really underestimated the appetite for radical change, in the electorate. And I think that has to be deeply connected to, you know, a sort of over reliance on data, and also it's both a failure to quantify correctly, but also a failure to correctly read the emotional temperature of the country. And that emotional aspect is really important to me, because, you know, I feel like we're living in this era where we're all talking about, you know, numbers and data and facts, but the way that someone feels about something is also has the force of the fact, and we often treat emotion and people's perceptions of their personal situation as being sort of something subjective. And in a certain way it is. But for that person, it really does have the force of a fact. Well, and we need to take that seriously.
Right. I mean, well, I feel like I should speak up for data nerds and just say that, as my understanding, I'm not very smart about this stuff, but I think just because that they, you know, they said something had an 80% chance of happening that didn't happen, that doesn't mean that they were inherently wrong. Although I agree with you that I think people probably got a poor impression of the strange things going on in the United States just from looking at percentage numbers from data heads. But I guess what I want to ask you is, it feels to me, and maybe we disagree here, but it feels to me, you talk about people's feelings and how important they are and their emotions and so on. It just feels to me that the single article in journalism I've read the most in the last year and a half is telling us how Trump voters are feeling and what they think about things, and just them going on and on ad nauseum about their different feelings, whether they're connected to reality or not. And so I'm sort of sick of that piece about sort of the white working class and, you know, how they're thinking about things. I mean, do you think that there hasn't been enough of that, or you think the article should be written a different way?
Oh, I absolutely think there has been more than enough articles about, you know, the downtrodden white working class from a kind of anthropological perspective. For me, it's more of a question of tone and perspective, right? And this is why I talk about writing for rather than about. There's been a lot of what I like to think of as elite splaining. You know, you'll have reporters from New York or Washington or LA or San Francisco fly into some Appalachian town and write about how awful things are. And their primary goal is to explain that awfulness and help the readers of these publications understand how these people feel. But I think that's very different from writing journalism that's actually addressed to the lived experience of the people who are actually experiencing it. And I think a lot of the kinds of things that I'm thinking about are things that local journalism used to do. You know, I think tabloid, New York City tabloids, for example, or the big Chicago tabloids, really saw themselves as representing the point of view of the working person, the person who feels like they're getting screwed by big, powerful institutions. So I think that it's not necessarily that we need more of these kind of safaris into Trump land, but I think something deeper and truer is needed. And what the exact format of that is or what it looks like, I think I'll know it when I see it, but it's definitely not just going out and asking people how they feel.
Elite-splaining is the whole point of this podcast, so don't be too critical of it. Let me ask you this about reaching Trump voters. You know, when I go to HuffPost every day and I check on the headlines and I read your stories, and I say this not critically because I work for a place, Slate, that does the exact same thing, but I notice at least, and especially in the last few months, sort of incredible levels of sarcasm and often wit and just kind of, I don't want to say condescending because I enjoy it, but very acerbic tones towards Trump and what's going on in the country. And I do wonder, along the lines of what you're saying about reaching a broader audience, I mean, I don't think that the reason Trump voters maybe don't trust the New York Times is because the headlines are too acerbic, but I do wonder how anyone who's sympathetic to Trump or his point of view coming to HuffPost, it seems like immediately they would be turned off because the first thing they see are headlines mocking them.
I would take issue with the characterization that our headlines mock people who support Trump. You know, our orientation is not to one party or one politician or against one. I mean, our orientation is towards power, and it's an antagonistic orientation. The person who has the most power right now is Donald Trump, and so our journalism towards him is going to be pretty antagonistic, especially given the program that he's trying to enact in Washington. You know. But I would also say that I don't see us as trying to win over the Breitbart audience. And to be frank, the audience for Breitbart is shrinking by the day, right? I mean, I think I read in the Washington Post the other day that their traffic has plummeted by 53% or something. You know, their advertisers are fleeing. You know, I was very convinced by the Margaret Sullivan column arguing that, you know, the point is not to say something nice about Trump, as the New York Times Week in Review section says, but to be tough and fair and to choose what you emphasize and how much you emphasize it. I've been trying to make sure that we are exhibiting a healthy balance between covering the internecine fights within the White House, which are very entertaining, the who's up, who's down. You know, Sessions is losing influence. Bannon is up. You know, Jared Kushner isn't on speaking terms with Trump. All of that kind of coverage, to me, is not really our wheelhouse. You know, as I speak, we have the main splash on our homepage is a piece about the history of the food stamps program and what the Trump budget might mean for it. So for me, it's really about the kinds of stories that we choose to emphasize and the impact that they're going to have on people, rather than necessarily thinking about, you know, kind of the who's up, who's down type of coverage of Washington, which is what you're seeing from a lot of other news organizations.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that I think we have enough who's up, who's down coverage you see in the media. And I was actually just reading that food stamp piece, which I think is the type of thing that people should be writing about. I guess my point was the headline of that piece is Making America Hungry Again, which I agree is not mocking Trump voters per se, but it's sort of mocking this whole idea of behind Trump's campaign, which I guess gets to my larger question of, when you're dealing with people who have different ideas of facts as well as opinions, it's not just that people have a different point of view on, you know, whether a woman should have a right to have an abortion, also questions of whether global warming is happening, all these things that we know how Trump voters or many Trump voters think about things. Do you have some idea of how you can reach those people in a way that other news organizations haven't? Or because it seems like you don't think it's a lost cause.
I don't think it's a lost cause. I think most people are fundamentally not ideological, and they tend to their views tend to be formed by the people around them and the things that they care about on a day-to-day basis. So a lot of, you know, there was a significant number of people who voted for Trump after having voted for Obama in 2012. I mean, it wasn't the majority of Trump voters, obviously, but there was a sizable chunk. I think it was around 12%. So I mean, I hate to think of this group of people who voted for Trump as this massive monolith. And to be fair, you know, I think it's just as important for us to reach out to people who didn't vote at all, people who are sort of so alienated from the political process that they're just not even really paying attention. I think a lot about people who don't really read a lot of news or don't consume a lot of news. That group of people, I think, is a really important audience for HuffPost. I also think that, for me, one of the most important ways that you can make news connect is through emotion. And so, and I would include humor and sarcasm as emotions. And that's something that we definitely get from the tabloid tradition, right? That you use your headlines as a way to really kind of like smack people in the face with, this is what the impact of this thing is going to be. So, in the example of the food stamp story, we had a picture of a bread line from the Depression era and, Make America Hungry Again as the headline. The goal is to really kind of put front and center for the reader how far of a step back this is and how the food stamps program came to be in the first place and the bipartisan consensus around the idea that the wealthiest country in the world should not have people that are hungry. And in order to make that emotional connection, I think you need to have that in your face. Here's a picture that really brings that home and a headline that really brings that home as well, but speaks with real sort of power and emotion rather than a dry kind of Here are the numbers for the number of people who use food stamps or some sort of policy analysis. That the emotion is really a hugely important and compelling part of the package.
I want to talk to you about your reporting career before you became an editor. You were at the Times for about 15 years, I guess. What was your first? I know you did a little Metro reporting, correct, before you went overseas?
Yeah. I mean, I had your typical of the time apprenticeship. I worked at a couple of smaller newspapers, one in Albany and then one in Florida, the Orlando Sentinel. They're not tiny papers. Those are actually pretty substantial newspapers. Was hired into the intermediate reporter program at the New York Times when I was about 26 years old in 2002. And my sort of 2 years as a Metro reporter were spent doing the great things that Metro reporters typically do. I spent some time in affectionately known as the Shack, which is the absolutely disgusting warren of rooms at One Police Plaza, which is police headquarters here in New York City, kind of learning at the elbow of some of the great police reporters of the New York Times. I was sent up to the Westchester Bureau for a while to cover the suburbs, which was another sort of typical station of the cross. So, they kind of put you through your paces and you learn how to be a New York Times reporter. And it was incredibly exciting. I'd always had this passion, though, to be a foreign correspondent. And at the earliest opportunity, I put up my hand and said, oh, I'd really like to do this. And, the opportunity came along sooner than I thought. There was an unexpected vacancy in the West Africa Bureau, and they needed someone who was available to go sort of on a moment's notice. And being young and unencumbered, and blessed with a spouse who's kind of up and game for anything. I packed up and moved in at the end of 2004 and became the Dakar correspondent.
And so what from a foreign reporting maybe specifically do you think you learned that changed the way you think of the job of editing?
that's a great question. The wonderful thing about being a foreign correspondent is that you're really kind of a one-man band. Your editors are very far away. They can't really micromanage your work. And that's especially—
So don't micromanage. That's the lesson, apparently.
Well, it's especially true when you're in a place like West Africa. And I mean, I ended up ranging even further and did some work in East Africa as well, and spent time in Congo, more Central Africa. But the great thing about being a correspondent in Africa, especially for the New York Times, is that it's this wonderful combination of the Times has this deep commitment to covering Africa, and to having really sort of strong and rigorous coverage. I mean, they continue to have three bureaus. bureaus on the in sub-Saharan Africa, which I think is a pretty significant commitment. But there's not a lot of guidance or, dare I say, meddling to say this is what you absolutely have to cover. So you have a tremendous amount of freedom. And you know, I had a very clear idea of the things that I was passionate about, and I did a fair amount of conflict reporting, but I was also really interested in the development of democracy in Africa, because it's something that I had, essentially lived through. When I was 6 years old, there was an attempted coup in Kenya that actually involved Raila Odinga, who later became a leading political figure once again, and in another disputed election in Kenya, and then when I was in high school, and these were really kind of bookend moments for me, when I was in high school, there was a transition to democracy in Ghana, where the then military dictator Jerry Rawlings decided to run for office in a genuinely free and fair election. And, you know, having lived through these events, I was very passionate about this question of self-governance and democracy and, you know, the tension of importing kind of Western-style liberal democracy into developing countries. I was very interested in questions of development because that's the work that my father had done. He'd been an agricultural engineer and involved in vocational education and farming and that kind of stuff. And so, I'd seen up close the developmental policies as they played out over the years, you know, going from an emphasis on agriculture to one of macroeconomics and things like that, and some of the damage that came as a result of structural adjustment and the various ways in which, highly experimental theories about economic development were put into play in extremely vulnerable places.
Did it also make you think? I mean, there's obviously been a lot of talk here in the past couple of years about the strength or non-strength of our democracy and building institutions or watching institutions tumble. I mean, do you feel like that experience gave you any insight into what we've seen the last bit of time?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that when I was a correspondent, my favorite place to report was Nigeria. And the reason that Nigeria was so compelling to me was that it reminded me most of the United States. It's this, you know, very diverse, polyglot, you know, highly entrepreneurial country that in some ways shouldn't make sense, but manages to make sense anyway. There was perpetually a prediction that Nigeria was going to come apart because it was made up of too many different ethnic groups and, you know, too many warring factions. And, you know, eventually, of course, the United States did have a civil war, and Nigeria did have a civil war too, during Biafra. But, you know, in the main, the place is held together. And, I just always found it to be an incredibly compelling experiment in people from all kinds of different walks of life and religions and speaking different languages, trying to figure out and negotiate ways to exist together in the same space. You know, I covered the 2007 elections there, and most of those elections were completely fraudulent. There was ballot stuffing. There was all kinds of nasty things that happened. But, there are 36 governors in Nigeria. And I think in the end, the courts ended up awarding the wins to the vast majority of the legitimate winners after sort of a long process of, so, I mean, it's one thing to be able to hold a credible election. A country like Congo can have, you know, a beautiful election with lots of observers and ballot boxes that aren't stuffed and things like that, but it doesn't have the kind of basic furniture of democracy. And Nigeria kind of has the basic furniture of democracy. I have to say that coming back to the United States, and particularly in this era, I'm starting to ask myself questions about the basic furniture of our democracy.
It's funny. So after West Africa, you went to India, right? What year were you in India?
I want to say that I moved to India in 2009.
I think we both know a lot of people in India from in sort of the journalism world, and I just talking to people there about being in India at that time, they definitely feel like being there around that time really gave them kind of glimmers of insight into what's been happening here the last couple of years in terms of sort of right-wing use of social media going forward and things like fake news. And I was curious if your India experience, if you felt like that was helpful.
Oh, absolutely. And the parallels actually go back even further, right? I mean, I arrived just after the general election in India, where the Congress Party had been returned to power. And people thought that, you know, there had been a kind of permanent realignment and that the country had put behind it these, you know, deep divisions, you know, that the whole Hindutva, the right-wing Hindu thing was essentially dead and gone. You know, that Congress was going to basically govern, have an almost permanent governing coalition. And watching the sort of the back end of the Obama administration really reminded me of that moment, of that sense of inevitability that, you know, there was this kind of permanent Democratic majority that was coming into power and that all the demographics were on the side of the Democrats and that, you know, there was really no way that, that the Republicans were going to be facing a very steep climb in the future. All of those things played out in India almost to a T when I was there.
I just want to turn back to HuffPost and your work there. One of the things that you mentioned in your letter is you talk about your background. This is sort of when you were talking about journalism becoming highly concentrated in these urban centers. You said, you know, my father is a disabled vet. My mother is an African immigrant. I went to college in part thanks to a Pell Grant, a government program available only to the poorest students. My grandparents on my father's side were Goldwater Republicans. And, you know, I know you've talked a lot about diversity in newsrooms, both in terms of racial, gender, ideological, and so on. What did you see in terms of diversity when you were at the Times? And was there anything about it that you want to improve on in your new rule or change? New role, not rule, I should say. role, not rule.
Yes, with a scepter. I'm sitting here with my royal HuffPost scepter.
Your regnet.
Yeah. You know, I think all news organizations struggle with diversity, you know, and I wouldn't necessarily want to single out the Times as being any better or any worse. I think they've got a tremendous commitment to bringing in lots of different kinds of voices. And I think they've done a commendable job thus far of doing it. And I think nobody there is satisfied with how far they've come. You know, to me, you know, I think of diversity in very broad terms, as you said. You know, I went to college at a place called St. John's, which has this, you know, Dead White Men, Great Books program. It was very popular with conservative parents who sent their kids there because they wanted them to be spared from, postmodernism and intersectionality, although that term wasn't really a term of art way back when I was in college. But there were also, you know, people who were more like my parents who, you know, sort of liked the idea of the curriculum and wanted their kids to have a kind of unconventional education. And that's definitely what drew me to it. So I've always had a kind of, I've always been a kind of poor fit with the, you know, sort of lefty identitarian world, just because of where I was educated and how deep an imprint that left on me. The idea of a heterodox educational environment is something that, I mean, it's something that I really treasured. So ideological diversity is really important to me. I think this is a strange time, though, because if anything, class diversity seems to be the thing that journalism needs most of all. You know, I feel as though journalism has become a more elite profession. And, you know, I have a soft spot for people who went to state colleges, people who grew up in places outside of, you know, the great metropolitan areas of the country, you know, people who are people of faith, whatever faith that might be. We're all trying to make a more perfect union together, and it's a constant struggle.
Last question, which is that, you know, a lot of the news breaking we've seen in the last 3 or 4 months, is an overwhelming amount, I would say, has come from the Times and the Post, which obviously they have amazing journalists there. And also they have the kind of resources to throw a lot of reporters at an issue, whether it's Russia or whatever. I mean, do you think about how to compete with what they're trying to do? Or are you thinking that there's a niche to do something else? Or how are you thinking about that moving forward?
I think that the great thing about the digital age that we're living in is that everybody can read everything and everything feeds off of everything, right? I think it would be a poor use of our resources to try and replicate what the Post and the Times are doing. I think we need to pick the issues that we think are most important to our audience, that our audience is most passionate about and has the deepest effect on them, and really run after those. And so, you know, I look at issues like voting rights, like the food stamp bill, you know, the census, changes at the EPA, corruption, local government, things like that. Are we going to have every twist and turn of what's going on in the Oval Office and its environs? Probably not. Are we going to have every twist and turn of the Russia investigation? I don't think so. But we can use our journalistic resources to go after stories that we think are of paramount importance to our readers, and those are the ones that really deeply and truly affect their lives. Now, I think that the sort of Russia campaign story is perhaps the most important story in the country right now, because it really does call into question the legitimacy of our elections. But what's interesting is that we're seeing in our reader data that there is a considerable amount of fatigue about that story. And what that tells me is not that we shouldn't cover it, but that's not the only thing people want to be paying attention to. So we're trying to get out there and tell all kinds of stories.
Lydia, thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate having you on.
It's a pleasure.
And that's our show for today. I Have to Ask is produced by Audrey Dilling with help today from Daniel Schrader. Our theme music was composed by Doug Chase. Don't miss out on more episodes of this show. Go to slate.com/ask to subscribe. That's slate.com/ASK. One other thing today, I want to recommend another Slate podcast, which is called Trumpcast. The hosts are Jacob Weisberg, Virginia Heffernan, and Jamel Bowie. They rotate, and they talk about all things Trump. They go deep on his latest tweets, his scandals. They have questions for him. They air their concerns. It's a really phenomenal podcast covering all things Trump, and I really encourage people to listen to it. It's called Trumpcast, and you can subscribe to it wherever you get your podcasts.